Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lelchuk. We hope you'll subscribe and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Now, if you like the show, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. We believe now more than ever in providing a platform for individuality, free thought, and a diverse range of views. By supporting the show this way, you'll get early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and much, much more. Remember, the conversation is always active at Talking Beats Podcast on social media. Here's Daniel Lelchuk.
On today's program, we're wading into the torrid waters of Mideast politics, Israel, Iran, and the United States, and we have two extraordinary guests joining us. Making a return appearance on this program, Ambassador Dennis Ross, he's counselor, and William Davidson, distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He served in the administrations ranging from Reagan to Obama for more than 12 years. He played a leading role in shaping U.S. involvement in the Middle East, dealing directly with the parties in negotiations. A highly skilled diplomat, Ambassador Ross was U.S. point man on the peace process in both the George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton administrations. He was instrumental in assisting Israelis and Palestinians to reach the 1995 interim agreement. He also successfully brokered the 1997 Hebron Accord, facilitated the 1994 Israel-Jordan Peace Treaty, and intensively worked to bring Israel and Syria together. More recently, he was Special Assistant to President Obama and National Security Council Senior Director for the Central Region and Special Advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He's the author of a number of books on the Middle East, including most recently with his colleague David Makovsky, Be Strong and of Good Courage, How Israel's Most Important Leaders Shaped Its Destiny, as well as his flagship book, Doomed to Succeed, The U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. Also joining us is Michael Singh. He's Lane Swig Senior Fellow and Managing Director at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a former Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council. During his tenure at the White House from 2005 to 2008, Mr. Singh was responsible for devising and coordinating U.S. national security policy toward the region stretching from Morocco to Iran, with a particular emphasis on Iran's nuclear and regional activities, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, Syria, and security cooperation in the broader Middle East. Previously, Mr. Singh served as a special assistant to Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell at the U.S. Embassy in Israel. Mr. Singh has written extensively on the Middle East, broader U.S. national security strategy, and the organization and management of the U.S. national security apparatus. His writing has appeared in the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs, and he's been featured regularly as a commentator on CNN, Fox News, and many other outlets. Returning for the second time, Ambassador Dennis Ross. Coming here for the first time, Michael Singh. I'm pleased to have them both. Let's get started. Michael Singh, as you wrote in a very interesting February article, Biden's Iran dilemma, both Trump and Biden faced the same problem negotiating a stronger nuclear deal. Can you elaborate on what you've been observing over the past few months in terms of similarities of the challenge that Biden and Trump both faced and where you see things starting to go in the initial beginnings of this new administration?
Well, you know, I think that there are actually some points of broad agreement between Democrats and Republicans, and in a sense, at least implicitly, between the approaches of the Trump and Biden administrations. I think both of them feel as though their main foreign policy challenge is not in the Middle East, but is in Asia. It has to do with a rising China, which is seeking to project more power in the world. And what they want to do is to have the luxury, as it were, of shifting resources to deal with that problem away from places like the Middle East. That, of course, requires them to at least contain problems like Iran, which poses a nuclear challenge, obviously, but also poses other sorts of challenges around the region. both of them, I think, both Trump and Biden, both Democrats and Republicans, feel as though one way to do that is through diplomacy, by reaching a sort of stronger nuclear agreement. I think that there's consensus at this point that the 2015 nuclear accord, the so-called JCPOA, really is not sufficient to keep Iran's nuclear program contained. A stronger deal is needed, or at least desirable. But of course, there are strong differences in their approach to doing that. I think President Trump felt economic pressure would compel Iran to come back to the negotiating table, and he spent 2 years trying to ratchet up that pressure and sort of cajole Iran back into negotiations. President Biden, on the other hand, I think believes that the way to get Iran back to the table is essentially to form a united front with U.S. allies by going back into the 2015 nuclear accord as a first step, and then trying to persuade Iran to come back to the table along with our allies to reach that stronger accord. So far, though, we really haven't gotten anywhere. So far, we're still out of the deal, and Iran is still expanding its nuclear activities.
Ambassador Ross, the word diplomacy was mentioned by your colleague. I'd say it's fair to say you know something about diplomacy. And you've talked about before regarding this, about the need for the U.S. to continue to find the best point of leverage in the short and the long term regarding Iran. What is the best leverage right now? What are we doing, or should we be doing?
Well, it's a really good question, because there's obviously a search for what's the kind of leverage that's going to work. Mike was referring correctly to the fact that President Trump thought you could pretty much coerce through economic means the Iranians, and they would have no choice but to respond. And obviously, at least within the context of his first term or his only term, that approach obviously didn't work. There are those who will say, look, if you just keep it up, sooner or later, they'll have to give in. And there are signs that the Iranians unmistakably want sanctions relief, but they also have the ability to endure and don't seem to mind imposing real austerity on their own country, on its public. So I think economic leverage is a lever that can work, but obviously by itself is not sufficient. I do think political isolation also matters. And here, in effect, what you're seeing here, again, Mike was referring to President Biden's approach, which was create a united front. And with the united front, that'll bring the Iranians around, because the combination of political isolation, the reality of economic pressure, if they come back into the deal, then you will at least put the nuclear issue in a box for a period of time, and then you can go ahead and try to negotiate a follow-on. The essence of what you're asking, Daniel, is that going to work? Is there the right kind of leverage to produce an Iranian response in this? And I guess what I would say is, if we look historically, there is a pattern where when the Iranians define the cost as they measure it as being high, they find a way to adjust their behavior. So in the 1980s, they were fighting a war with Iraq. Iraq started that war by invading Iran. You had the then Supreme Leader Khomeini declaring that Iran would fight the war, the Islamic Republic would fight the war wherever long it took. And in fact, when the cost got too high in the end, he did this war being the equivalent of drinking poison from a chalice, but they changed their behavior. In the 1990s, when they were assassinating dissidents in Europe and the Europeans said they were going to impose sanctions, the Iranians decided that was too high a price, so they changed their behavior. After the U.S. defeated in 3 weeks the Iraqi military that the Iranians couldn't defeat in 8.5 years, they were then prepared to suspend in the early stages of their enrichment program. With the Obama administration, they said they would never negotiate on their nuclear program if so long as they were under sanctions, and when the U.S. actually tripled down on the sanctions, they did. And I think what we're seeing is they will adjust their behavior, but it's got to be the right mix of economic pressures, political pressures, and I would even say some coercive military pressures, at least fearing that the alternative to diplomacy could end up being use of force. Some combination of all of these is probably necessary. But again, it's going to come down to how the Iranian leadership defines what's the price that is, from their standpoint, one they don't want to pay, and do they have a way out? Do they have a diplomatic way out? So you're really producing a mix here of what is pressure, but also some sense of possibility. If anybody had an obvious answer to this, we would have seen it applied already.
I wonder if you could just put a finer point on the phrase you used, that maybe not everybody listening, this isn't a political or diplomatic focused podcast per se. So if you just zoom out for a minute, what is political isolation? What does that mean in real terms for a country to be politically isolated and politically squeezed?
Essence of it is pretty much that the rest of the world is pretty much lined up against Iran. Iran's self-image is that they're, you know, they have a great historical civilization. You can't isolate them. They're not the Hermit Kingdom. They're not North Korea. At the beginning of the Obama administration, everything that was done was designed to show we were prepared to engage the Iranians. They just weren't prepared to respond. And what we did is we lined up all the Europeans. We worked with the Russians and the Chinese. And pretty much you created this united front. So in a sense, Mike made this reference to it with regard to what President Biden is trying to do. The problem is it's not so easy to create what you had back in 2009. Today, there are talks in Vienna that involve the Russians, the Chinese, the British, the French, and the Germans with the Iranians. They're dealing directly with them. The Iranians won't deal directly with us. So what the Iranians have set up in these indirect talks designed to get back into the JCPOA, what they've set up is a situation where these four other countries these five other countries, Russia, China, the UK, France, and Germany, are dealing with the Iranians and going between the Iranians and us. Now that puts those mediators in a position where they almost have to represent, or at least at a certain point, advocate what the Iranians need. And they also want to show the Iranians that, look, talking with them offers some payoff. The point here is it's pretty hard to politically isolate the Iranians when the Iranians have mediators who are going between the two of us. Real political isolation would be a situation where all the members of what the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany would all be lined up adopting the same position vis-a-vis the Iranians. That's what was done back in 2009. That's political isolation. One of the things that President Trump did with his policy of what I call maximum economic pressure was he tended, at least politically, to isolate us much more than he isolated the Iranians.
Michael Singh, here's one thing that I was thinking about, you know, leading up to this. And let's say we rejoin this agreement, and then in the next election, someone else wins, maybe from another party, and then we leave it. And then there's a sort of yo-yo effect going on. I mean, how do we regain what was lost? Obviously, we can't go back in time. We were in the agreement. Now we're out. If we go back in, that's a third change. It seems tougher with each change of administration, change of opinion, we can somehow get this going in the long term in the way that we all want. What do you see what I'm saying? Isn't that a worry?
I do. I mean, it's absolutely a worry. And I think there are two different issues at play here when this sort of in and out yo-yo approach to issues like Iran that we see from one administration in Washington to the next. And that's, you know, first and foremost, any deal, any diplomatic deal is judged against U.S. interests. It's judged against the kind of perception of the sort of strategic landscape of the world. You know, we look at a particular deal, we say, is this deal that's on the table, is this deal that we're in better for American interests than whatever the alternative might be? And I think that one thing we're experiencing now in Washington is that while in the past, you know, we might have seen, you know, a pretty good overlap in how Democrats and Republicans, conservative and liberals, saw the world strategic landscape, saw U.S. interests, maybe there's an increasing divergence there. And so not only do, you know, the different parties have different policies, but they have sort of a different way of looking at the world. And so maybe one party looks at a deal, whether it's the Iran nuclear deal, whether it's the Paris Climate Accords, and says, hey, this is good for U.S. interests, whereas the other one says, no, not at all, in part because they see a different reality in the world. And obviously, you could sort of extend that to the domestic scene as well. I think the other issue, though, is that anytime you're in an international negotiation, in fact, you're also in a domestic negotiation. If any international agreement is going to succeed, you also have to have a sort of negotiation away from the table, as it were, to put together not just a diplomatic coalition, but a domestic political coalition that is sufficient to sustain the agreement, to get that agreement cemented, to get it passed, if necessary, within Washington, and then to ensure that it can outlast whatever political moment you're in, whatever administration is carrying it forward. And so I think this is a lesson that the Biden administration will have to take from the 2015 experience, that they're negotiating not only with Iran and not only with the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese, but they also have to negotiate with critics at home. And ultimately, whatever they achieve, if it's going to last, will also have to satisfy some sort of minimum sufficient number of those domestic critics.
Ambassador Ross, jump in and expound a little more on what he was just saying. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's essential. I think we are in a different place. And think about it even from the Iranian standpoint. If the Iranians are going to end up having to make certain concessions, which they will have to make, they also want to know that if they make them, it's not just going to be reversed as soon as there's a different administration. So even from the standpoint of the adversaries that you're dealing with, you want to show that what you're doing is sustainable. Clearly, you want to show it for your allies as well. Very few countries, whether they're allies or partners, are going to go out on a limb for the United States if they think whatever our posture is good only for the life of one administration. So we do have a need now. And it's not that it's new. It's just that it's more pronounced. In the past, we did have examples of real differences between the political parties. I recall when Jim Baker became the Secretary of State in the Bush 41 administration, the first thing he did was to take on what he saw was the most politically charged issue in foreign policy, which was Central America at the time. The whole issue of dealing with the Contras, the Sandinistas, the war in Central America. And one of the very first things he did within the first weeks of his being Secretary of State was to go up and sit with the Speaker of the House at that time, Speaker Wright, and sit with leading Democrats as well as Republicans and forge what was a common approach. Before, in fact, anything was done on the outside, he wanted to demonstrate on an issue that was so divisive domestically and politically in foreign policy, he would forge an understanding. And I think what Mike is talking about is you really need to take a page from that kind of experience and be able to apply it. Now, it would seem to be natural for President Biden because he is, by dint of his own experience, someone who has worked across the aisle. Now, one can argue that the circumstances are different, things are more polarized now, but precisely because of that reality, you have more of an obligation, I think, to reach out, at least in the foreign policy area. I get in some of the domestic issues, certainly with the stimulus structure, you might want to get bipartisanship and it won't be so easy to produce. There are areas where I think commonalities can be forged. On China, I think that's clear. On Iran, it's hard right now. And unfortunately, the JCPOA became kind of an emblem of division between the parties. And somehow, some way, the Biden administration is going to have to find a way to reach out to the Republicans and address some of the concerns they've raised so that, in fact, a more sustainable posture is adopted.
Just to pick up on something you mentioned, how do you avoid, sort of circles back to a few minutes ago, how do you avoid being viewed that our word as a country is only as good as the duration of an administration? It seems really a tough sell right now.
Well, it is, although You know, there are areas, even with two administrations as different as Trump and Biden, and it's hard to imagine two administrations that could be more different. And yet there are certain continuities. In a sense, China is one at this point where you're not seeing a fundamental difference. Maybe the difference is more in style, but less in substance. It doesn't mean it may not evolve over time. You have the Abraham Accords, which Biden came out immediately as the one issue during the campaign where he wasn't critical of Trump and instead immediately embraced it. So here are at least two issues where you see this kind of continuity. I think one thing the administration will want to play up are, again, it's you have to take into account the politics of it, but there are areas where there are continuities, and at least when you're dealing with either your allies, your partners, or even your adversaries, you can communicate what are consistent American interests. And I think the more you can elevate that, the more you can address the issue you're raising. But I can't wish away that problem. It's there. There is a perception of us right now that whatever is adopted by one administration may not be sustained by the next. And that's a challenge for any administration to figure out a way to contend with.
Michael Singh, unless you had anything to add on that, I'll bring in another element which we haven't touched on yet.
Well, I agree with Dennis. So I would only say that I think that ultimately, when countries reach agreements with one another, they're doing it because it's in their interest to do so. And so I think that I'm not sure it's a new phenomenon for, you know, agreements to be temporary, for, you know, arrangements to not last forever. I think this is simply how international affairs work. You know, change is really the only constant in the world. I think what is different now is that other countries regard the United States as less predictable. I think in the past, other countries felt as though they had a sense of what the foreign policy consensus was in the United States. They had a sense of where the differences were between Democrats and Republicans. I think the broad sense now in the world is that that's changing rapidly. And other countries are finding themselves a bit sort of whipsawed by some of the changes that they've seen in American foreign policy. And that, I think, produces a behavior that we call hedging. You know, they're in addition to reaching agreements with us, which they still have to do because the United States still is the preponderant power in the world. They're also trying to do things to protect themselves in case our policy changes. And that might be sort of making sure they maintain good relations with Russia and China. It might be taking steps to insulate their trade or financial systems against American sanctions. That kind of hedging behavior can pose a real cost to the United States because it might dilute the value of our relationships and our agreements in a way that disadvantages us, frankly.
You mentioned Republicans and Democrats. How different are Republicans and Democrats on Iran right now? And I'll just say as a little anecdote, I remember about 10 years ago sitting at my family's breakfast table up in New Hampshire, and Benny Morris was there in between good coffee. He was banging his fists on the table saying that Israel must strike Iran. This was about 10 years ago. Or I don't hear people really clamoring for that now. Does that mean that there's more consensus, or that people are sort of all in agreement that no, a strike is absolutely the worst thing possible?
You know, it's tough to answer that question. You know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, certainly when I was working on Iran policy in the White House, you know, Iran was the issue that seemed to unite Democrats and Republicans more than any other. You would have sanctions bills passed in Congress, you know, with, you know, 100-0 vote in the Senate with regularity. Because there was agreement that we simply can't allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. Also, broad opposition to Iran's support for terrorism and its policies around, I think, to a great extent, that consensus still exists. I think that underlying all of our policy disputes, everyone could still agree that absolutely in no case would we want to see Iran develop a nuclear weapon. And I think opposition to Iran's policies is still quite deep and quite broad. I think, though, there are two things going on. One is the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear agreement, has become a sort of politically symbolic issue where all Republicans are against it, all Democrats are for it. And that's connected not just to the substance of the agreement itself, but it's sort of it's become a sort of political sort of football, in a sense. In part because it was President Obama's signature foreign policy agreement, and obviously there was a good deal of polarization during that period more broadly. Second, though, I think it reflects a degree of fatigue and uncertainty about America's role in the Middle East more broadly. I think that there are a lot of folks these days in Congress, but probably even beyond Congress, that see the Iran issue perhaps as something which is keeping us mired in a region that they would rather we find a way out of. And then there are others who I think really worry that, you know, we'll sort of rush for the exits too quickly and find ourselves suddenly vulnerable to the threats that are emanating from the Middle East. And so I think it's those disputes rather than really disagreement on Iran policy itself that produces so much of this polarization that we're seeing right now.
Dennis Ross, it's interesting because the nuclear deal, the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA really did take on a toxic politicization almost in a way that mask wearing did during the pandemic. I mean, an absolutely, totally polarizing thing. It's a shame that it became that, isn't it?
Well, it is, because what Mike points out is absolutely right. If you ask Democrats or Republicans on the Hill, should Iran have a nuclear weapon? The answer is absolutely not. If you ask them, does Iran engage in destabilizing, threatening behaviors in the region? They say absolutely. The prescription for dealing with this threat is different, and it is connected to something that Mike was saying. It's hard to remove the politics. I was going to say remove the politics, but it's hard to remove the politics because the JCPOA was kind of the crown jewel of the Obama foreign policy, and the Republicans lined up uniformly against it. And obviously, Israel was a factor here, and Prime Minister Netanyahu was a factor here, because he saw the JCPOA as fundamentally flawed in the following sense, that it legitimized a very large nuclear infrastructure for Iran. And it had sunset provisions, which meant that by the year 2030, the limitations on the Iranian nuclear program, the size of its nuclear infrastructure, would basically be gone. There would be continuing monitoring and verification, but the program itself would expand dramatically. Now, Republicans, because maybe they believe that, some saw this as a potential wedge issue politically to be able to affect Jewish support for Democrats. There are political factors here that came into play, but there was also a basic disagreement on whether this ultimately would do what it said it was going to do in terms of preventing Iran from having a nuclear weapon. And there was this overlay of the sense of the forever wars in the Middle East, that we get involved in these wars there, the costs are very high, nothing improves. If anything, it seems to get worse. And as Mike said, being mired in the Middle East became this kind of dividing point for many. The militarization of American foreign policy became a dividing point for many. And so there are those within the progressive wing of the Democratic Party for whom, you know, their focus on Iran, I would say, is less pronounced, and they sort of see those who want to pursue what is a tougher policy towards Iran as wanting to perpetuate the kind of militarization of American foreign policy, especially in the Middle East. So you have all these different factors that I think have helped to somehow transform what is still a kind of consensus that Iran is a problem and it shouldn't have a nuclear weapon into very different views of what it takes to how to prevent them from having a nuclear weapon. And we hear the term just use diplomacy as if it's an end in itself. As someone who is engaged in a lot of negotiation, and as you know, Daniel, I did use the word leverage not only here, but the last time we spoke, to back diplomacy with threats, meaningful threats, is oftentimes what makes diplomacy more likely to succeed than not. And so if you emphasize diplomacy to the exclusion of everything else, your odds of being successful with it, I think, go down. And that's, I think, one of the things that's been lost in terms of this debate.
Are we actively engaged right now to the degree that you think we should be in terms of diplomacy backed up by real threats? Are we doing that enough, or is it too early to tell?
I'm not sure. Well, I'll put it this way. I'm a little worried that the Iranians perceive the United States now as being so determined to avoid a conflict and so fearful that if the advance of the Iranian nuclear program isn't halted soon, that it'll end up leading to either Israel using force or even the United States having to use force to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon. So I am worried that our deterrence of the Iranians has diminished, and it is important for us to reestablish it. Now, that doesn't mean you have to go use force, but it does mean your declaratory policy is going to have to be different. Your public effort to sort of frame the issue so that while our preference is for strong diplomacy, the Iranians also have to play ball. And if the Iranians make successful diplomacy impossible, they're going to leave us other choices that will have to be exercised. Coercive choices, covert choices, even military choices. The idea is to prepare the ground in a way that justifies that, particularly with an eye towards convincing the Iranians this is where things are headed, unless they're prepared to engage in a way that gives diplomacy a chance to succeed.
I want to get both of your takes on the potential divisions here between Israel and the United States. There's an article, opinion piece out in today's Jerusalem Post by Yaakov Katz saying, will Iran deal change with parade of Israeli officials to D.C.? The unanimous understanding in Israel is that America is recklessly racing toward a deal with Iran. Agree or disagree, both of you?
Well, you know, I think that the sort of disparity in perspective between the U.S. and Israel has in part something to do with geography. You know, Dennis was just talking about this sort of fatigue that many Americans, including policymakers, have with the Middle East. And when we look at something like our diplomacy with Iran or any of our other policies toward the region, one question we're asking ourselves, I think, is how can we shift resources away from the Middle East and towards higher priorities? Higher priorities like great power competition, so-called great power competition with Russia and China. And so, in part, you have to look at policies through that lens, you know, ensuring that this makes sense, not just in and of itself with respect to Iran or whatever other threat exists in the Middle East, but that it makes sense in the broader scheme of American national security strategy, in the broader scheme of American foreign policy priorities. Israel is stuck in the Middle East. Israel's not going to leave the Middle East. It doesn't have the option. It has to live with Iran forever, essentially. And so I think that gives Israel a very different perspective. Israel worries about a future, I think, where the United States is drawing down in the Middle East and Iran perhaps feels emboldened. And so I think the key for the United States, therefore, is to, if we really do want to avoid, you know, reaching a deal or formulating a policy only to sort of see it blow up and see ourselves dragged back into the region in a way that takes us away from other priorities, we have to take the perspectives of our partners and allies into account, because we're never going to be indifferent, as Dennis said, to Israel's fate, to Israel's security. And I think you can do that. You can do that by, of course, first and foremost, consulting with them as you seek a diplomatic deal with Iran, but also ensuring that that deal is situated in a sensible and robust regional policy that addresses whatever threats, and there's going to be many of them, that can't be addressed through that deal. And I think you can do that by helping our partners build their own capabilities. You can do that by trying to forge cooperation, a tremendous stride towards that in the last couple of years with these so-called Abraham Accords, normalization or sort of peace deals, as some have said, between Israel, the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and so forth. And so I think the point is you can address some of the concerns your allies have while also trying to maintain a coherent set of national security priorities. It's not easy to do, but I think that it is possible, and that will really be the challenge for the Biden administration.
I really very much agree with what Mike said. Let me just add a couple of points. One critical point is that given Israel's history, and given Jewish history, by definition, when you see something that could constitute an existential threat, you have to take it seriously. The consequences of not doing so are all too apparent. So that's just part of the Israeli DNA. And that is obviously something that tends to elevate certain kinds of threats in a way that we might not see them quite the same way. But I don't think there has to be a difference, because we do share the same fundamental objective that Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon. What Mike was talking about in terms of consultations with the region, taking into account their concerns, is part of how you address this. For the administration, I will say, it isn't enough just to talk to the Israelis or to talk to the Saudis and the Emiratis about their concerns. They're going to have to show that they're taking those concerns into account by some of the actions we take. If they want to persuade the Israelis and others that our approach on the Iran nuclear issue, by getting back into the JCPOA to begin with, can work, then we have to show how we can continue to apply leverage, to apply pressure on the Iranians, and we're not giving it all up. The Israelis and the others in the region fear that once the Iranians are back in the JCPOA, once the nuclear-related sanctions are lifted, and the Iranians are actually pushing for much more than that now in these talks in Vienna, that they'll have no incentive either to do a follow-on agreement or to change anything they're doing in the region. So for the follow-on agreement, you're going to have to say, we're prepared, actually, after a set period of time, say a year or 18 months, if there's no agreement, we're prepared to reapply the sanctions. In the region, you can picking up on what Mike was saying, you can make it clear we're prepared to compete with our allies, with the Iranians in the region, and raise the cost to them. It doesn't have to absorb us in terms of American forces, which is the big fear that many have. But what it can mean is that we do more to plan with them, to bring them together, to deal with contingency planning to counter the Shia militias, and to develop options where they, working together with our support, can do more to raise the cost of the Iranians. We do more to build their capability to defend against ballistic missiles or cruise missiles or drones. We do more to enhance a kind of coalition building based on what Mike was referring to with the normalization process of the Abraham Accords. What we want to do is show we will work with them in a way that takes into account the concerns they have. If we're saying the right words, but it's not backed by actions, then the kind of differences and doubts we're seeing are only going to magnify.
It is a little strange to wonder about the effect of Israeli attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities all the while the talks in Vienna are happening. Does it amplify a message? Does it distort the potential for progress in the talks? I'm thinking also of the killing of the scientist a few months back. What does that do to what Iran wants to do?
Well, I would just say one thing quickly. A lot depends upon whether or not this is done with American awareness or not. I mean, if it's done without American awareness, then it is bound to create greater fissures between us and the Israelis. If it is done with an American awareness, not because the U.S. is saying, go ahead and do it, it actually sends a kind of interesting message to the Iranians. Because what it's saying is, we want diplomacy to work, but we have other means to basically disrupt your program if you're not prepared to engage. And I would just say, there were all these people, there were many pundits who were out there saying, once this was done, the Iranians would walk away from the talks. Well, they didn't. They want sanctions relief. That's what they very clearly demonstrated. And they're using pressure from their end to try to get it by accelerating their nuclear, creating an impression now with enriching to 60%. They're trying to say, look, unless you lift the sanctions, our nuclear program's going full speed ahead. And they're trying to play upon what is the fear on our side, or with what they perceive to be the fear on our side, that sooner or later could lead to force, and we want to basically be able to put their nuclear program back in the box. So from my standpoint, I don't see this as necessarily being inconsistent. I think it can actually reinforce your diplomacy, but there needs to be some coherence between the U.S. and Israel in this regard, and it shouldn't policies that where one or the other is confronting, whether you're an ally or a partner or an adversary, surprises, diplomatic or otherwise, usually, as I like to say, they usually tend to drive everyone into their fetal position. So better to be keeping between the U.S. and Israel, better to be keeping both sides very much in the picture of what they're doing.
Mike Singh, anything to add there?
Well, I think it's important to remember, Daniel, that Iran, since 1979, has had a very hostile stance towards not just Israel, but essentially all of its neighbors in the region. And we've seen Iran build up, for example, significant proxy forces in places like Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, you know, shipping missiles to these places, shipping drones, providing military advisors, and so forth. And so I think it is simply not surprising that Iran's neighbors, the folks in its region, are not going to be sanguine about Iran's development of nuclear capabilities. And that's, I think, from the U.S. perspective, from the perspective, frankly, of both Democratic and Republican administrations, why there is a burden on Iran to submit to inspections, to demonstrate that its nuclear activities are limited and that they're strictly peaceful in nature. And that ultimately is what these talks are about. They're about trying to, again, sort of contain and sort of deter Iran from marrying those nuclear capabilities with what has been a very aggressive set of policies towards its neighbors. And if those talks fail, if diplomacy fails, we shouldn't be under any illusion that the alternative is that Iran's neighbors will simply shrug their shoulders and say, well, nothing we can do about it.
I'm going to take you into a totally different world because, as Ambassador Ross knows, you probably know too, this show isn't called Talking Beats for nothing, meaning music. And I always talk about music with everybody here, the physicist or poker player, anything in between. We spoke about country music last time with Ambassador Ross, and a lot of people really got a kick out of hearing his tales, listening to country music in the car and singing along with it. Mike Singh, what is music for you? Are you a music lover? What role does it play in your life?
Well, that's an interesting question. I know I've never gotten that question. Yes, I mean, I love music, and we're not a musical family in the sense that I don't know that we have too many musical talents, but we love music. And in fact, you know, I do confess to sitting around with my sons and my wife and doing karaoke at home, for example. You know, it's we have, I think, pretty broad and eccentric musical tastes. You know, Dennis, if Dennis was talking about country music, one of the things that I enjoy, my wife enjoys, is bluegrass music, for example, which is within easy driving range of Northern Virginia, thankfully. If you drive just a couple hours west of my home to West Virginia, there's a tremendous heritage of country music, but specifically bluegrass and sort of Appalachian music, which, you know, you can sort of draw the line from that kind of music to music of, say, the British Isles, you know, Irish music and so forth, which is also something I enjoy, particularly because my mother is originally from England. And so half my family lives in the UK. And so it's just fascinating to me sort of to hear this, not just to hear this kind of music, which I enjoy, but also to sort of enjoy the historical connections, because so much of which is, you know, uniquely American.
One of the things that it's so sort of sad about the past year is that a lot of the music you're talking about really isn't written down. It requires people to be together, requires people to sit down, the 85-year-old with the 25-year-old, and say, this is how we play it. And a lot of it's really passed down. It's an oral tradition. It's a great oral tradition. And it's so important that people get back to being able to make music together. I mentioned to you before we got on this call that I just played my first live concert with people a week ago today, sold out immediately. And then we added another concert last night here in Virginia. And that sold out immediately too. And the idea of people coming around safely, but hearing something live, it really is as there's nothing like it. But you would agree, Ambassador Ross, I think, right?
Completely. Look, I think it's also it's kind of the human connection, but it's also creating a sense of some normalcy again. My wife and I have had both of our shots, and we've begun to get together with people again. It feels natural, but it's also a reminder of what we've lost. And yes, I would love to be able to go to concerts again and look forward to being able to do so.
Can I say, Daniel, though, that I think one thing that we have sort of gained out of this past year, maybe counterintuitively, are some weird connections over music, right? I mean, my sons, who are both teenagers, enjoy listening to these TikTok videos of sea shanties, for example. There's one in particular that's really popular, called Wellerman. And it's, to me, fascinating that one thing that, you know, YouTube and TikTok can do is take a, you know, 1800s sea shanty from New Zealand and turn it into a viral sensation amongst 13 and 14 year olds around the world during a pandemic. So absolutely, we all want to go back to seeing live music, but you know, this past year of being connected virtually amid lockdown has also produced some sort of strange collaborations and strange phenomena.
Daniel, can I ask you in this year, what have you done with your own music?
Well, at first, I think when everything shut down and, you know, going from playing 130 concerts a year to zero takes a bit of getting used to. But once I did, I ran to post things on social media like everybody else did. But I got a little tired of that pretty quickly, actually. How many versions of the Bach cello suites were being uploaded to Instagram with, you know, the sort of poor microphone and poor camera quality. I mean, it was very charming at the beginning. Luckily, this podcast, being able to always bring music into these conversations, which I always do, has been quite stimulating, and I think stimulating for listeners and guests as well. But I did go the longest I'd ever gone without playing a concert, and I did first time I played with another musician was in July, and that was just a duo, a bassoon and cello duo, and it was an incredible feeling. And to be here in Castleton, Virginia, at this very, very special theater that the great Maestro Lauren Mazel built, carrying on some of that tradition here in recordings and videos and now live concerts, really is something very special. And the power of music, hardly is it diminished by having been in silence for a year. Absolutely strong, stronger than ever. And the feeling of the people who are listening, people are coming up to me afterwards and they're saying they feel alive for the first time in a year.
Well, it's like we're looking again to reestablish connections, not virtually, but real connections. And music can obviously be one of the means for doing that.
I wondered, in terms of connections, diplomatic connections, how hard is it to conduct diplomacy through a screen? I mean, when you're on a video call, there's that green light at the top of the computer. And to give the illusion that you're making eye contact, you have to look into that camera and that green light, and then nobody's actually making any eye contact. You're just giving an illusion. I mean, how much is lost in terms of diplomatic conversations and practices when it has to be conducted remotely?
I do think it's obviously it's not the same. If you have an existing relationship, then I think it's less of a problem. If you don't have an existing relationship and you're trying to create it this way, it'll be much more difficult. As someone who's done a lot of negotiations, I would just say reading body language has always been an important part of engaging in negotiations and thinking through where you are and when's the time to be trying out certain ideas, when's the time to be prepared to run certain risks. Hard to do that in a kind of a Zoom setting. But I would say the key, for me at least, the key dividing point is, do you have an existing relationship already? If you do, you can... Zoom doesn't seem to change a lot of that. And I think one lesson is a lot of the travel that we might have done in the past, we're going to find we really don't need to do nearly as much as we did before.
So, you know, I think that when you zoom out, though, beyond just the negotiating room, you do see that you lose a lot when you can't spend time in person with your counterparts and when you can't be on the ground overseas. I think that, you know, it can be overstated. It can be exaggerated sometimes. But, you know, forming personal connections with diplomatic counterparts, you know, over meals, over coffee, during breaks and so forth, is just a tremendously important part of diplomacy because it helps you establish trust. It helps you establish understanding. And while you can't let those things sort of cloud your, you know, sort of vision of your political agenda, of your interests, it's important for smoothly conducting diplomacy and successfully conducting diplomacy. I think it's also just incredibly important to actually get on the ground overseas if you want to understand the world, if you want to understand the context in which your foreign counterparts are operating. There's really no substitute for travel. There's no substitute for, you know, landing in a place like Cairo or in a place like Riyadh or even Paris, and simply walking around and getting a sense of the place, getting a sense of the people. Because ultimately, you know, all of us who are engaged in diplomacy are representing someone and something else. And I think that in diplomacy, you need to understand not just your individual counterparts and establish trust with them, as important as that is. You need to understand who and what it is they're representing if you're really going to understand their perspective, their interests, where they're coming from, and so forth. And to me, knowledge of foreign countries, knowledge of the world, it's a wasting asset. You need to constantly refresh it. And so I'm looking forward to just getting on a plane and getting back out into the world.
I agree with that. I'm not sure I have to do as much as I did before, but I do agree. There is also a certain level of intensive concentration when you're in a different place. I can be talking to people all the time overseas, over Zoom or otherwise, and I won't learn as much as if I'm there. And I think it's sort of a testament to what Mike is saying.
I can relate very closely. I've had the very luxurious position. I've been traveling and playing concerts everywhere from Middle East to China to New Zealand, all through Europe and everything. And there's nothing like that personal interaction, not just going on stage, but also getting a meal with people afterwards, struggling with a foreign language, out to dinner and have a drink and discuss things that aren't exactly pertinent to why you're there, but get to know a bit about the person. That's a hard thing to recreate artificially over a screen. Let me ask you both to sort of wind things up. Not that we need to end with a false optimism, but what are you optimistic or perhaps even a little positively surprised about regarding all of this now, regarding Iran, regarding the developments of the past few months or the lack thereof? What's giving you some hope and what are you looking forward to happening?
You know, I think the most hopeful development in recent years is really these new connections among U.S. partners. It's something that a lot of us who've been working on the region had hoped for some time, but to actually see it happen is remarkable. And I think that, you know, for the sake of the people of the Middle East, for the sake also, frankly, of U.S. interests, this is really crucial. A Middle East where, you know, you have Israel and key Arab states. You know, obviously, Israel's had peace with Jordan and Egypt for some time. With Egypt, it's been a relatively cold peace. But to see greater integration in the region not only means potentially for the United States a sort of grouping of partners that can take the initiative, take action themselves in place of the United States, which would free us up to pursue other priorities. It also raises the possibility of more economic integration, more trade, more people-to-people exchanges, and ultimately more peace and prosperity for people in the region. You know, Iran obviously stands outside of that right now. And I think that it put a burden, frankly, on countries like Iran to decide if they're going to continue to try to stand athwart of that kind of political and economic progress, or if ultimately they have to relent. And I think it's, again, not just a sort of incredibly powerful strategic card for the United States, but it's very sort of positive at a human level as well. And so I think it's just crucial that we build upon that.
I agree. I mean, look, the normalization process in the Middle East is basically something that is a whole new dynamic. Those who began to cooperate with the Israelis below the table because the Palestinian issue was seen as too toxic at a certain level, too much of an issue that could be mobilized against them and actually destabilize anybody who would actually seek to make peace with Israel. The reality is what began as a kind of strategic convergence over common threat perceptions between Israel and a number of the Gulf states has been transformed into what is a genuine process of peace building. We've had negotiated pieces that produced, as Mike said, kind of cold peace. We now have peace emerging that has a warm content. You've had 140,000 Israelis go to the Emirates in the midst of a pandemic over the space of 6 months. I mean, it's quite extraordinary in terms of that. You had the Emiratis insisting that the number of flights between Israel and the Emirates needed to be four times what the Israelis were initially proposing, precisely because they wanted to create real connections. And the significance of this is not just that it begins to say that Arabs and Israelis actually can cooperate, and not just have the absence of war, but actually have a content of genuine peace. It also sends a message. This is apropos of what Mike was saying. Think about Iran. Wherever Iran is, whether it's in Lebanon or Syria or Yemen or even the leverage it has in Iraq, every place where Iran has extended itself, uses the Shia proxy militias, has leverage and uses coercion, every place where they have that kind of influence, the state is either failing, failed, or in a deep struggle. And the contrast with looking backward and being mired in conflict and having no hope whatsoever, with those who are dealing with real issues now, like food security and water security, and offering what can be a very different future, that creates a picture for the Middle East that could be very different as we look ahead, given what we've historically seen. And it makes me hopeful. I used to say so often when I would give talks about the Middle East, I felt like at the end I had to pass out antidepressants. But right now, with everything that's going on, I don't feel that way. I feel like there is something we can point to that is extremely hopeful.
Well, I'd say the lack of the need to give me an antidepressant sounds pretty hopeful. So I like that. Ambassador Dennis Ross and Michael Singh, it's been a great pleasure. You're both, as you know, terrific. And I hope there's a next time to do this. It's been a great pleasure.
Ours too.
Thank you, Daniel. Real pleasure.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.